Hey there, it's Joshua. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. The Friday News Roundup, of course, was recorded earlier, so we discussed a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta has announced his resignation. This after an attempt at defending his role regarding a decades-old case he played a pivotal part in. California billionaire Tom Steyer changes his mind and has gone on attack, entering the race for president. Many Disney fans shared news of two more live-action adaptations of animated classics and America's Champions come home.
We have to be better. We have to love more, hate less. We gotta listen more and talk less. We gotta know that this is everybody's responsibility. Every single person here. Every single person who's not here. Every single person who doesn't want to be here. Every single person who agrees and doesn't agree. It's our responsibility to make this world a better place.
That's Megan Rapinoe, the lavender-haired co-captain of the U.S. women's national soccer team. She spoke Wednesday in New York following a parade down Broadway to celebrate the team's latest World Cup win.
There's been so much contention in these last years. I've been a victim of that. I've been a perpetrator of that. With our fight with the Federation. Sorry for some of the things I said. Not all of the things. But it's time to come together. This conversation is at the next step.
And our conversation with the Friday News Roundup is just beginning. Joining us here to help make sense of this week's big stories is NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Laura Meckler is a staff writer for The Washington Post. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And at NPR in New York, Ested Herndon is a national political reporter for The New York Times. Ested, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Would that we could spend the whole hour talking about the Women's World Cup, but there's a breaking story with which we must begin, involving Jeffrey Epstein and the Labor Secretary Alex Acosta. Epstein is well known in certain wealthy circles, and now he's a household name thanks to new federal charges of sex trafficking of underage girls that were filed against him in New York. Labor Secretary Acosta has become better known because of the Epstein case, but he will soon have a far lower profile. This morning, the White House announced that Acosta will resign, the aftermath of scrutiny he faced over Epstein's prosecution. Back in 2008, Epstein and the Miami U.S. Attorney's Office reached a deal to end a federal investigation of his involvement with at least 40 teenage girls. That ended with about a year in jail and the requirement for Epstein to register as a sex offender. At the time, Acosta was the U.S. attorney for South Florida. His critics claimed that he helped orchestrate a kind of sweetheart deal for Epstein. Secretary Acosta addressed that this week at a press conference.
I've seen the interviews on television of these victims and their stories. And so it's hard. But I also think it's important that we understand that the men and women of my office, going back to 2006 and 2007 and 2008, have spent their career prosecuting these types of cases. And in their heart, in our heart, we were trying to do the right thing for these victims.
That was Labor Secretary Acosta speaking at a press conference this week. Domenico, let me start with you. Can you give us a better sense of what was wrong in the eyes of Acosta's critics with this deal that he signed regarding Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, the deal that he signed was one that a lot of them, as you noted, they believed was a sweetheart deal, was something that he served less time than perhaps he would have if they, had prosecuted him to the fullest extent. Acosta tried to argue that it was a different time 12 years ago or 10 years ago, 11 years ago, that, you know, that their victim shaming was something that lawyers would do and that this was something that would be maybe a difficult case to win. There is a lot, though, that was reported in the Miami Herald, for example, last year about Acosta's role in this, about him stepping in. And the Palm Beach County state attorney had blamed Acosta for what he said was negotiating a deal and going over his head. Now, the police at the time blamed that same state attorney for quashing what they felt was could have been bigger charges. So there's a lot that was going on there. A lot of this was aired, but obviously got way more attention after the Epstein charges were, the new ones were brought. It looked like Acosta was going to be able to hang on to his job after his press conference that was encouraged by the White House to go ahead and do that. And then today, the White House is saying it was Acosta's choice to step down. This was not forced by the president, wasn't a result of the optics. You don't know what the reality is there necessarily, but from what they're saying, it was his choice.
And we should just be clear. We're talking about two sets of prosecutions. We're talking about Barry Kircher, who was the state attorney in Palm Beach County, Florida at the time. That's where the 13 months in jail in state in lockup took place. And then the federal prosecution, that's what Alexander Acosta was part of. He was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida. And that's the piece that Acosta is involved with. It's this overlap between the state prosecution and the federal prosecution. Laura, I wonder what you make of this public reckoning. He, in his statement, tried to explain his reasoning, but also was kind of hesitant to go too far because he said this is still an active federal prosecution now in New York.
I also think he was hesitant to go too far because the further you go, the more his actions get scrutinized of how he handled this. Because as you said, there were these state charges, but there also was a very robust federal investigation and indictment that was pending that he essentially let drop in lieu of the state charges, that those two separate prosecutions were wrapped up into one. I think that it was all becoming very uncomfortable for him. Now, this was known. Let's be clear that this admit was known when he was nominated for the post. It was talked about during his confirmation. But I think the whole thing, well, I know the whole thing became, you know, far more difficult for him and became a huge lightning rod when the new prosecutors, the federal prosecutors in New York this week, or was it last week, decided that they were, it was on Monday he was arrested, that he was going to be prosecuted for very similar charges. So essentially now we have the prosecutors in New York saying, hey, look at what we found. They went to his house. They found hundreds, maybe thousands of pictures of nude girls. They found incredibly disturbing allegations from new sets of victims. And then the question became, well, Acosta, you were in charge of this at the time. Why didn't you push this harder? This is horrifying. And this was that spotlight shone on him so brightly.
The new allegations included from a woman named Jennifer Arose. She says she was a victim of Epstein's when she was 15 years old. Here is what she told NBC's Savannah Guthrie this week on Today.
Did Jeffrey Epstein rape you?
Yeah, no, he raped me. Forcefully raped me, but knew exactly what he was doing. And I don't think cared. What hurts even more so is that if I wasn't afraid to come forward sooner, then maybe he wouldn't have done it to other girls.
That was Jennifer Arose, who accuses Epstein of victimizing her when she was a teenager, speaking on Today on NBC. Astead Herndon, what about the fallout for the Trump administration? The president has defended Secretary Acosta in the past. Donald Trump also has past ties to Jeffrey Epstein. What about the fallout for the administration or potential fallout?
Yeah, we see this kind of cycle come up with this administration often. As cabinet officials are caught up in scandal, I can think back to Rob Porter. I can think back to kind of other administration officials who are caught up in more corruption scandals. You have this cycle that kind of develops. The president comes out and initially defends him, often because it seems to be that his instinct is to defend those who are on his team. And then as the scrutiny grows, as the headlines get worse, and that heat increases, the president either turns on them or that person ends up stepping down. So even though a couple of days ago we had that press conference in which Secretary Acosta was defending himself and the White House was voicing support, those kind of keen followers of the White House should know that that doesn't often mean much. So it's no surprise that we come to this point of his resignation today. I mean, I think when we look at the political fallout for the White House, it will not only be Secretary Acosta, but what about President Trump, who who has his own relationship with Epstein. Is that something that can come up as this lawsuit develops? We don't know that. But I think as you talk to kind of political folks, that's the bigger worry, is the president himself, seeing that they're now a little more capable of cutting ties with the secretary. But this is a scandal in a lawsuit that's going to wrap up a lot of different institutions, not just the White House. There are banks, there are financiers, there are New York circles that were all kind of involved in enabling this alleged predator for so long, and someone who was a registered sex offender for years. And so all of that, including the White House, is going to have to face the music as more facts develop.
Before we move on from this, Domenico, we haven't heard that much from Jeffrey Epstein or his legal team this week. We've heard mostly from Acosta, who's been trying to defend his actions, and also from Julie Brown, the investigative reporter from the Miami Herald, who blew this story open. But we haven't heard that much from Epstein in the last few days.
No, we haven't. And, you know, I think you would expect that he would lay low, given that any attorney would say in something like this that's this serious and this emotional and facing these kinds of charges that he should probably stay quiet. And that's what they're probably advising him. And that's what I would expect.
One more story, just a quick mention involving a federal case of a high profile man on sex charges. You may have heard that R. Kelly was arrested in Chicago yesterday on federal charges, including child pornography, enticement of a minor, and obstruction of justice. More charges could come today. Kelly was taken into custody last night. He's being held at a correctional facility in Chicago. The allegations of sexual abuse against the 52-year-old singer date back to 1998. We'll continue the Friday News Roundup in just a minute with NPR's Domenico Montanaro, Laura Meckler of The Washington Post, and Ested Herndon of The New York Times. One more question about Acosta that we'd like to get to before we move on. Freedom to Be tweeted, "So Acosta has resigned. Nothing changes. We will not wake up a week from now and suddenly human trafficking victims can more easily pursue justice. The entire Labor Department is entrenched." I'd love your sense of what this means for the Department of Labor when we come back. We'll also check in on the Gulf, bracing for what could be a nasty storm this weekend. And we'll talk about a big casting announcement for a Disney remake. Maybe you'll recognize her voice. I'm Joshua Johnson, and this is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com, to try Babbel for free.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. The Gulf Coast is bracing for Tropical Storm Barry, the second named storm of this year's hurricane season. The National Hurricane Center says it's on track to make landfall on the Louisiana coast, possibly as a Category 1 hurricane. Forecasters expect strong winds and major water hazards, including one of the deadliest threats, storm surge. The flooding in New Orleans is already bad, but forecasters expect rivers in Louisiana to rise as much as 6 feet. It's the Friday News Roundup with Washington Post staff writer Laura Meckler, Ested Herndon, a national political reporter for The New York Times, and NPR's lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Let's wrap up on Alex Acosta and Jeffrey Epstein before we move on. Wanda in Estero, Florida writes, "Why not give credit to the Miami Herald for their investigative reporting? They're the ones who brought this story back to life." Well said, Wanda. We have. And if you'd like to go back and listen to our conversation with Julie Brown of the Miami Herald, you'll find it online at the1a.org. But if ever there was a justification for subscribing to your local paper, just look at Julie Brown's work in the Miami Herald and then tell me it's not worth your money. Freedom to Be tweeted, "So Acosta has resigned. Nothing changes. We will not wake up a week from now and suddenly human trafficking victims can more easily pursue justice. The entire Labor Department is entrenched." Laura Meckler, what about that? Where does this go from here?
Well, I think the main implication for the Labor Department is that it'll be yet another cabinet agency that doesn't have a permanent leader. You know, Trump is going to have to find another nominee, going to have to get that person through the Senate. There's been an enormous amount of turnover in this administration, in the cabinet as well as in the White House itself. I think due to a variety of controversies that have come along and also due to the nature of the president's leadership and how he approaches his relationship with his top people, when they become difficult or there become problems, they seem to disappear. And that's what's happened here. So I think that there's, you know, no doubt that this will lead to some instability at the Labor Department. The deputy, it looks like, is going to be acting as the acting secretary. So presumably that person, you know, will keep the trains running on time and doing what they need to do. I think it's also notable that, you know, relations with labor and in terms of the work of labor unions is not exactly at the top of the Trump administration agenda. But there are, I believe, some questions there about how quickly they are going about rolling back some of the Obama initiatives that came out of the Labor Department. So we'll see if that might impede that progress even more.
And by the way, as for who the Deputy Secretary of Labor is, it's a man named Patrick Pizzella. He previously served on the Federal Labor Relations Authority under President Obama back in 2013. The president designated him acting FLRA chairman when he took office. Prior to that, he served under the George W. Bush administration, so got a little bit of experience serving both Democratic and Republican administrations. Let's move on and talk about immigration. Before we get to the matter of the census question, let's just look at the numbers of what's happening at the border. Instead, the latest numbers from the Department of Homeland Security show that arrests at the southwestern border dropped quite a bit by 28%. What do we make of that drop? Are fewer people coming? Is this just a blip? How do we read this?
It's hard to know. I mean, what we do know is that border arrests have been decreasing for a while. That was even true under the Obama administration. That could be because folks are feeling more comfortable in their home countries. That could be because of other reasons. The kind of measures that the Trump administration has put in may, you know, the kind of Republicans say that the president has deterred people from coming across. But what is clear is that the kind of crisis that the White House is articulating at the border doesn't necessarily always square with the facts. And we have those kind of lower number of entrants and lower number of arrests, which would seem as if that the massive amount of resources they are diverting to the border, the kind of state of emergency declared, that is why some Democrats say that those things are unnecessary. But we know, again, as on the kind of politics side where I sit, this is something that the White House has tried to use, to drive up interest from its base in both the midterm elections. They use the kind of coming, quote, unquote, a caravan of migrants to drive interest among their base to get to the polls. And we had that true in 2016 as well. And I think that everyone can kind of bet that if this White House plays the same political playbook it's looked at for the last couple years, as we ramp up into 2020 elections, it is likely to point to the border crisis to try to say that Democrats are, quote unquote, open borders candidates, which isn't really based in fact. But that's the political strategy just as much as it's a policy one.
Laura?
Well, everything that he says is absolutely right about how this has been played politically. But I think it's also important to note that the border apprehensions have really spiked in recent months. I mean, the numbers in May, which is the previous month that we had, had information for, were far higher than they've been for many, many years. I don't know if you remember, but in the Obama administration, there was a crisis with people coming to the border and unaccompanied children and families arriving at the border that spiked. Well, this is way higher than it was then. I mean, so the numbers have gone up. You know, the question is, you know, why? And I think that the answer is that there's continued violence in Central America. People want to leave. Obviously, the Trump policies actually, I don't think, have been working very well to discourage people from coming, as hard as they are trying to crack down on many, many different ways. But the numbers have been rising. And so what was notable in June is that they did drop. But keep in mind that even the June number is still far higher than it's been for at least the last five, six, 8 years. So and probably further back than that.
Domenico?
Those June numbers are actually the highest since 2004. Usually you do see a decline in summer months of border crossings because it's hot, right? And it makes it a lot harder to make that kind of travel across lots of places. And I think Laura's exactly right, that overall the trend is that you're seeing more people coming, and that has everything to do with the conditions in those countries. So when the administration wants to say the conditions that, you know, of arresting people, detaining them, all of that, while they think those things could potentially be deterrents, there's very little evidence that they actually are.
Let me stick with you, Domenico, for the announcement that the president made yesterday. He spoke from the Rose Garden and publicly backed off from his fight to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. That had gone to the Supreme Court, and justices ruled that the administration could not add the question unless it could give a stronger, more defensible reason for why it needed to be there. The president says that instead he's going to seek information from existing documentation that other federal agencies collect to kind of get at the same goal of figuring out how many undocumented immigrants are in the U.S. What does that mean going forward? I mean, can those data be used for immigration enforcement?
Well, first of all, the president wound up coming to a conclusion yesterday that all of us knew 2 weeks ago. He essentially threatened to put this back on the census in some way. He even mentioned a rationale that most people thought was the real rationale, which was wanting to use this for redistricting. It was not the rationale that was used by the administration before the Supreme Court. And I think that's really important, because when you look at redistricting, redistricting is meant to be done by counting all persons who reside in the United States. It's not intended to be done based on citizens. Now, that appears to be what the president wanted to do. He's still sort of making a vague threat that states can use the citizenship data to determine their apportionment. But the way apportionment works is, one, it's based on the census, but also on the same day of that census ruling by the Supreme Court, it also said that the federal courts have no role in controlling gerrymandering, the process by which there's political redistricting. So we're in the Wild West. These states are going to be allowed to continue to do whatever it is they want as far as how to gerrymander, how to draw these districts in ways that benefit them politically. State legislatures are allowed to do that. And the places that have total control by one party or another are going to be able to gerrymander to their heart's delight.
To the point you made, Domenico, about border crossings, Jerry is listening from State College, Pennsylvania. And Jerry writes, as someone who worked on the border for two decades, I can tell you this. In June, daytime temperatures frequently rise above 100 degrees. Apprehensions by the Border Patrol have long dropped throughout the summer months. Instead, with regard to apprehensions, that's one thing that the administration is not backing off on, these immigration raids that had been announced. And according to the Times, sources say that the raids are set to start taking place this Sunday. What do we know about what's going to go on with these raids? There had been some contradictory claims as to whether or not it's even going to happen.
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, the reports coming out of multiple outlets were that the administration had targeted these kind of increase in apprehensions for a while. There was kind of reports about it some months ago that was then put off. There is now some saying that the kind of scope and scale and target of these are, again, under question. But what we do know is that the administration has for some time wanted a quote-unquote like show of force around the issue and wanted to particularly target communities and cities that were largely Democratic or urban centers. And so that's the kind of extent to the kind of factual questions we know for sure about this. But again, I would point back to the kind of political ones. I mean, this has been an administration that has tried to use these more dramatic instances to drive interest among their political base that has not necessarily been reflected in the need for in the kind of policy need, right? Like, there is not a lot of evidence that these type of raids would make these communities safer or are coming from a place where the community or local officials want them. This is a federally dictated or White House-driven policy or show that is meant to drive interest and that is meant to kind of show the administration to the speak to their own group of supporters to say that they are accomplishing the kind of the mandate that they feel that they were sent to do.
Laura, here's a quick clip of the acting head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Ken Cuccinelli. He spoke to reporters on Wednesday. Here he is responding to a question about the specifics of the raids.
Yeah, well, we're not going to say when the operational elements are going to roll out. And Matt Albans is in control of that at ICE, career man. And,
are they
going to
happen?
To it. They're absolutely going to happen. There's approximately a million people in this country with removal orders. Of course, that isn't what ICE will go after in this. But that's the pool of people who've been all the way through the due process chain.
That's Ken Cuccinelli, the acting head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Worth noting, Laura, there are still quite a few Americans who believe that this enforcement is necessary, who are convinced that the southern border is unruly, that more does need to be done to control the flow of migrants through the southern border, despite what they're going through on a humanitarian effort. You know, the build the wall rhetoric still exists to an extent. I'm not sure what your I wonder what your take is on the politics of this and whether any Republicans are really worried about the implication of this messaging.
Well, let's keep in mind what they mean when they say a final order of removal. Those are people who have often had claims that were litigated through the immigration courts, and a court has ordered them deported. So from the Trump administration point of view, and from the point of view of people who believe that we need to put an end to illegal immigration, if you don't then deport people who have been ordered removed, there's very little incentive not to try your hand at crossing the border. Because what happens is most people who come across the border, quote, illegally, they're not actually sneaking across the border or trying to evade Border Patrol. They're not, you know, just sneaking in and then disappearing into the country. For the most part, they're showing up and they're turning themselves into border agents. Why are they doing that? Because they believe they'll ultimately get to stay. And if you don't, in fact, remove people who have final orders of removal, they're right. They will get to stay. So that is the argument for executing this. Now, the question, though, becomes, we have approximately 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. What are your priorities? Now, under the Obama administration, they limited enforcement basically to people with serious criminal records. What Trump is viewing it much more broadly, going after people with these final order of removals. And we should add another group, too, which is people they happen to encounter when they're out in the field. Let's say they're targeting dad who has a final order of removal, but his wife is with him or a neighbor happens to be there and those people are undocumented. Doesn't matter whether if they're still here illegally and they don't have a right to stay, they might get swooped up as well. So it is a much more aggressive approach. It's one that obviously Trump supporters very much support.
There were a few stories involving the president and social media this week. And a little advice for when those internet trolls and Twitter haters get too loud, usually you block them. For most people, that's not a problem. But for President Trump, it's a little different. On Tuesday, an appeals court ruled that for the president to block his critics on Twitter is unconstitutional. Now, there's a similar lawsuit that's been filed against New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yesterday, the president held what he called a social media summit at the White House, not including Facebook and Twitter representatives, but a number of far-right social media influencers who claim that they've been treated unfairly by Twitter, Facebook, and others. Now, we should be clear. The First Amendment does not govern Twitter and Facebook. They have the legal right to block whoever they want or to restrict whoever they want. The issue is whether the president, in his authority as the chief executive of the U.S., can block critics. What does this mean for the president's relationship with social media? Domenico?
Well, it means that he can't block people. And, you know, the fact is, I don't know, I'm like Dikembe Mutombo on Twitter, man. Like, they come at me, they're not getting to the room. You know what I mean? Like, they're blocked. But
it's better just block them.
Just, you know. Right. But at the same time, I understand the instinct to do that. But what the court is saying here about the president is that because of his perch and who he is, that he's not going to be able to shut off people from actually seeing what is a vital communication to people. You know, when I talk to reporters about and other editors about whether or not we should be covering the president's tweets, we shouldn't go overboard with the tweets, but the tweets are a presidential statement. And, you know, it's like if the president were to set up a microphone on some street corner in Washington, D.C. and make a statement, you can bet cameras will be there. You can bet people will listen. You might not air them necessarily, but the court is essentially saying that everybody in the country has the right to at least hear what that statement is.
In fact, if you go to the official presidential Twitter feed at POTUS, it says tweets archived. And it says yeah. These are going to be preserved for posterity. But Domenico, I don't think we expect this to change the president's Twitter practices?
Well, he might have to not block people or unblock them. Certainly those who were, sued over this are, have a case to say that they need to be able to follow him now.
Much more we want to discuss as we continue the roundup with Domenico Montanaro, Laura Meckler, and Ested Herndon. We want to talk about a case against the Affordable Care Act that's being argued in New Orleans, and much more to discuss about the 2020 field of presidential candidates. Before we pause, here's one other story that caught our eye this week. You know, they say that content is king, and the newly formed conglomerate Warner Media is taking back some of its hit content for a new streaming service. Next year, Warner will move the hit sitcom Friends off Netflix to its new service called HBO Max. Friends is one of the top streamed shows on Netflix, but Warner Media owns Warner Brothers, which produced Friends. A lot of media companies are quickly building streaming services to try to out-Netflix Netflix, including Disney Plus, CBS All Access, and an upcoming service from NBC Universal. We're back to the roundup in just a minute. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR. We do long-form interviews with journalists breaking the big news stories and with the authors, filmmakers, and musicians behind the best in pop culture. So listen and subscribe.
Back now to the roundup with Ested Herndon of the New York Times, NPR's Domenico Montanaro, and Laura Meckler of the Washington Post. Laura, let me come to you and talk about the Affordable Care Act. There's another court challenge in a federal appeals court in New Orleans that could affect coverage for millions of Americans, similar to a previous prosecution. On Tuesday, two of the three judges on the three-judge panel gave the appearance that they might side with a lower court judge. The lower court ruled that the ACA was unconstitutional. That was back in Texas. And the decision could determine whether the case goes back to the Supreme Court. I don't want to read too deeply into what this appeals court case could mean, but what are some of the possibilities depending on how this shakes out?
Well, there are a few possibilities. One, of course, is they could say that, yes, the law is completely constitutional. I don't think didn't look that way from the arguments, but you never know, overrule the lower court entirely. The court could just say that the individual mandate, the requirement that all Americans carry health insurance, is unconstitutional. Now, the heart of that traces back, if we recall, when the Supreme Court somewhat surprisingly rescued and saved the Affordable Care Act in 2012, they did so on the logic that it was a tax, that Congress is allowed to impose a tax, and that's what the mandate was. It was, if you do not have insurance, you pay this penalty or this tax. Well, through the tax bill under Trump, that penalty was reduced to zero. So we really don't have a tax anymore. So the question before the court now is, okay, there is really no tax. So under the Supreme Court ruling, does that mean the mandate goes away? So the court could just say the mandate goes away, but the rest of the law stays, or they could agree with the lower court and invalidate the entire law. They say, and this has been an argument that's been made by people on both sides of this issue, that the pieces of the law interfit with each other and interact, and you can't just pull one of them out. And I would just highlight one very important provision of the law that is closely tied to the mandate, which is the requirement that insurance companies cover people even if they have pre-existing conditions. The argument long has been made by health policy experts and others that you can't ask insurance companies to cover everybody if you don't have a requirement that people have insurance. Otherwise, somebody finds out they're very sick and goes out and buys insurance.
Right.
Well, the insurance system doesn't work very well if that's the case. So that part could, and that's the most popular part of the law, is this requirement that you hold, that you recover people with pre-existing conditions, one of the most popular. So I think that this is a puzzle, and I think that the appellate court will see whether they invalidate the mandate, invalidate the entire thing.
Carrie writes, I live in Texas, and the only way I can afford insurance is through the ACA. He, meaning President Trump, he wants to get rid of it so bad, but why doesn't he offer something to take its place instead of just leaving me and a million other people in Texas stranded? Astead Herndon, I wanted to come to you on a similar point. We know that the administration tried at the very beginning of its time to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. That went through Congress multiple times and never quite succeeded. But now on the campaign trail among the Democrats, I'm hearing less about the Affordable Care Act, although they do talk about defending it, and much more about what the next phase should be, a public option, Medicare for all. It seems like health care is a big issue for 2020, but the Affordable Care Act is now just a piece of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, what is true now that was true 2 years ago and will be true in 2020 is that healthcare is probably the top domestic policy issue among voters. How that is articulated depends on candidate to candidate. In the last Democratic debate, you had a kind of split emerging that's true on the campaign trail. Also, among Democrats who more vocally want to look at a single payer, Medicare for all option that is mostly Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and then sometimes Kamala Harris, depending on how you read her statements, and the Democrats who want to build on the Affordable Care Act and kind of phase in a Medicare for all option, and then some who just reject that idea and are looking at things like a public option or a Medicare buy-in program or the like. But what you do have, I think, is to the point you're saying, is Democrats talking about ways the Affordable Care Act did not solve the problems of cost and access for all Americans, and what is the best way to go about that in the coming year. So I think what was the lesson that Democrats and Republicans took from the Trump administration's efforts to roll back the Affordable Care Act was, one, you cannot just repeal, right? Republicans had that mantra for years and years about repeal and replace, and it was a lot easier in word than in actual action. When they tried to get to the point of rolling back of repealing the Affordable Care Act by itself, people like the listener who just wrote in were wondering, well, what happens to my insurance that I got through that plan? And when they tried to find solutions, those were not ones that the Congress could agree on. So what Democrats are trying to do is actually have a replacement option that grows the amount of people covered. Who and what that option should be depends on the candidate.
Domenico?
You know, stepping back to look at the sort of landscape, bigger picture of the intersection between politics and the law, what we're seeing with this case kind of coming back and conservatives kind of flexing their muscles and saying, hey, let's get this back to the Supreme Court. It's really indicative of where we're at and the fact that this could be the courts could be the biggest legacy consequentially of what President Trump leaves behind when he leaves office. Mitch McConnell laid the groundwork for him, the Republican Senate leader, when he blocked numbers of President Obama's federal judges. President Trump has been able to push those through with McConnell's help at record rates. And now he also has a conservative majority at the Supreme Court. So all of this groundwork has been laid, and it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to turn that aircraft carrier around.
Speaking of the Democrats, let's talk about the field of Democrats running for president, because this week that field grew by one and shrank by one. Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents part of the Bay Area, announced that he is pulling out of the race.
We have to be honest about our own candidacy's viability. Today ends our presidential campaign.
But another Californian, billionaire philanthropist Tom Steyer, made an announcement of his own.
If you think that there's something absolutely critical, try as hard as you can and let the chips fall where they may. And that's exactly what I'm doing. My name's Tom Steyer. I'm running for president.
Laura, what do we make of Swalwell's departure and Steyer's entry? We asked Tom Steyer on this program in the past whether he was thinking about running for office, and he was kind of cagey, and I guess now we understand why. Right.
Exactly. Well, cagey is better than, you know, denying it and then doing it anyway. Well, yeah, so yeah. There you go. You know, I think that Monday began when we found out that Swalwell was leaving, with the political world being like, okay, maybe this race is going to start getting moving towards a little more under control in terms of the number of candidates. And then by day's end, we had another one, which, you know, answering the Democrats, you know, coast to coast desire for more choices. I think that he has another voice. He's a billionaire. He has a ton of money. He has mostly made his name in recently with calls and a lot of money behind ads urging the impeachment of Donald Trump. So I think that we should definitely expect that issue to get injected into the Democratic race. It's not necessarily something everybody wants to talk about.
Well, if he qualifies for debates, and you know, the next round of debate, he would need 65,000 donors within the next, what day is today? Well, the next four days?
I don't think he's going to make that. Yeah. I mean, he's got one himself, but, you know, maybe that's not really.
He makes
really,
65,000 deposits.
Yeah, I don't think he could do it that way. So, no, I don't think he'll be in this debate. But, you know, if he sticks around and he makes it to the next debate, and if his voice becomes one that's part of this conversation, I think the impeachment discussion may heat up a little bit.
Domenico?
I think unquestionably this race is going to be filtering very quickly down to a very solid top tier of candidates. The Democratic National Committee has doubled the standards for the fall to get on the debate stage in September. You're going to need at least 2% in the polls, 130,000 donors. There are not a lot of candidates who are meeting that, despite there being two dozen candidates in the race. The only ones right now who look like they could definitely make it are Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg. That is a difficult bar, then. We're looking at that as a pretty distinct top tier compared to saying, wow, there's so many candidates in the race.
But hey, that shrinks the field, right? As opposed to like two nights of 10 people, one night of five people.
Yeah.
It might not be great for ad revenue, but you know, that's the network's problem. So Tom Steyer may or may not qualify for these debates. As you mentioned, Domenico, there may be five or fewer who are qualifying at this point, but we should reflect back on another presidential debate from back in 1992. Remember Ross Perot? That third-party candidate who shared the stage with Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, it became a career-defining night for Perot. And this week, he passed away, died from leukemia at the age of 89. Perot was a billionaire, a Texas tycoon who got 19% of the vote in 92. It was the strongest showing for a third-party candidate in the past 80 years. Now, we still feel the influence of some of his ideas and his rhetoric, which takes us back to that 1992 debate. Here is what Ross Perot famously had to say about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
You can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money. There will be a giant sucking sound going south. So if the people send me to Washington, the first thing I'll do is study that 2,000-page agreement and make sure it's a two-way street.
That was Ross Perot talking about NAFTA during the 1992 presidential debate. He died this week at the age of 89. We're winding down, but let's talk about the economy. Stocks hit a new record high this week after the Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, testified before Congress about the challenges facing the U.S. economy. Here's part of what he said on Wednesday to the House Financial Services Committee.
Our baseline outlook is for economic growth to remain solid, labor markets to stay strong, and inflation to move back up over time to the committee's 2% objective. However, uncertainties about the outlook have increased in recent months. In particular, economic momentum appears to have slowed in some major foreign economies, and that weakness could affect the U.S. economy. Moreover, a number of government policy issues have yet to be resolved, including trade developments, the federal debt ceiling, and Brexit. And there is a risk that weak inflation will be even more persistent than we currently anticipate. We're carefully monitoring these developments and will continue to assess their implications for the U.S. economic outlook and inflation.
That was Fed Chairman Jerome Powell speaking on Wednesday to the House Financial Services Committee. Instead, Herndon, there's so much to potentially pay attention to. You know, Fed Chairman and Chairwomen always choose their words super duper carefully. Jerome Powell has been something of a political football for Donald Trump lately. The markets like the way things are going, but as Kai Rizdahl of Marketplace is fond of saying, the markets are not the economy. What should we be paying attention to?
Well, I think this is one of a kind of myriad of factors that play into the kind of the way we will look at this. I mean, certainly, as you have said, the White House has tried to rein in Jerome Powell and try to kind of exert its influence and try to tell a very specific story about the economy, tell one that looks at those kind of macro numbers and tells one that that continues the economic growth that started during the Obama administration. But there are some who say that, like, those numbers are kind of hiding a coming kind of retrenchment. And so I don't think we necessarily know or can predict kind of where this is going. But I can say, as again, as someone who spends a lot of time on the Democratic campaign trail, there's two different stories of the economy you are going to hear over the next year from the different political parties. One that says that the that there has been the type of robust growth, again, using the kind of decrease in unemployment numbers and the like. And then one that tries to tell a story about inequality, tells a story that's saying that those that type of growth has not reached the most disenfranchised communities and not reached the kind of communities that the president said he would uplift. And so where has that kind of, where has that gone to? Where has the economic growth gone to is going to be one question, but also, is it sustained? Whether this president goes into the next year with a more robust economy is a big difference than if he goes into one where it seems as if that growth is starting to dial back.
And Laura, briefly before we move on, what's to blame for the weak economic growth? What do we expect to be discussed as we get closer to the election, for example? I mean, the tariff war with China, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the questions of the of trade are huge. And as Chairman Powell said in the clip that you played, you know, that is still unresolved. We know wages is often an issue where that people pay attention to. You know, it's one thing for corporate profits to be up, and the tax bill delivered quite a bit of money to shareholders. But and we should note that the stock market is at an all-time high. I mean, that part is doing great, but is that working its way down to everyday Americans? I think when you talk about politics, that you always have to talk about that.
One last story that I think a lot of everyday Americans will appreciate, especially those of us who grew up in the 90s with lots of great Disney movies. There are some more live-action adaptations on the way. Last week, Disney dropped a trailer for a new Mulan. A few days before that, we learned that the casting for the lead role for an adaptation of The Little Mermaid was completed. Singer-songwriter Halle Bailey will play Ariel, not Halle Berry. Halle Bailey. She came to prominence as half of the R&B duo Chloe and Halle. She's been performing with her sister since before they debuted on YouTube at ages 11 and 13. Their album was nominated for 2 Grammys. They've toured with Beyoncé and Jay-Z. And speaking of the Queen Bee, she is getting kudos for her role as Nala in the upcoming live-action remake of The Lion King. That drops next Friday. This week, the first song from Beyoncé's new album, based on the movie, dropped this week. It is called Spirit, from the album The Lion King, The Gift. And as we leave you with the song Spirit, we say thank you to Laura Meckler, a reporter for The Washington Post. Laura, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Great to be here.
Ested Herndon, national political reporter for The New York Times. Thank you, Ested.
Thank you.
And NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're so welcome.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Iran is at the top of the news again this week after a confrontation in the Strait of Hormuz between a British-flagged oil tanker and Iranian vessels. Britain's ambassador to the U.S. has resigned after his frank and disparaging assessments of the Trump administration were leaked. Another political crisis is playing out in Asia. Beijing has failed to reassure residents in Hong Kong that it will not try again to push through a hugely controversial extradition law. More protests are in the works. And Turkey has upset the U.S. and other NATO allies by going ahead with buying a missile defense system from the Russians. Plenty to discuss today on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us to help make sense of this week's top international stories is Amna Nawaz, a national correspondent and some anchor for the PBS NewsHour. Amna, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Dimitri, welcome.
Thank you.
And Laura Seligman is a Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy. Laura, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with Iran. Tensions with Iran are still high, and as we said, not just with the U.S. A British tanker traveling through the Strait of Hormuz on Wednesday was approached by Iranian boats that tried to make it stop. It didn't work. The Iranian boats stood down, but it was one more move in a series of conflicts with Iran in the Middle East. Amna, let me start with you. We've heard about the strained relationship between America and Iran. But what happened here? What about the UK and Iran?
Yeah, the tensions have been rising there as well. It's important to say also the Iranians have basically denied there was any kind of confrontation. And the British have said, look, it was concerning and we want Iran to do what they can to de-escalate the situation. But there has been some back and forth between those two countries, specifically on maritime traffic, specifically there. Last week, the British basically helped to facilitate the seizure of an Iranian tanker that they've been holding on to. They said it was because of evidence that it was carrying oil to Syria, and then that was in breach of EU sanctions there. That has been part of an escalating series of tensions between the two countries. And the British since then have been sending in their tankers through this strait, which is a crucial maritime pathway, with Royal Navy ships. That's something Iranian officials have kind of made fun of and mocked them for doing. But tensions have been rising there as well. And that's, of course, all happening on the backdrop of the U.S., which is involved in all of this somehow, pulling out of the JCPOA last year. Iran has been trying to push those other three EU signatories to that deal to do something about it, to ease the sanctions, to help make a deal with them. And meanwhile, Iran themselves are pulling out piece by piece from that deal. So it's all interconnected. No country is immune from that tension right now.
And Amna, just to be clear, when we talk about British tankers having Royal Navy escorts, we're talking about ships that carry oil, mm-hmm. having armed escorts to make their route.
That is right, which is unsustainable for Britain, and everyone knows that. But it does speak to how serious that situation is and how high the tensions are.
Dimitri, could we back up a little bit and can we get a little bit of perspective on how we got to this point? I mean, this is not the first time that Iran has made moves against oil tankers off its coast.
No, there's been a series of things that have happened. And historically, there's also been, you know, things like this have happened in the 90s. So there's kind of a repeating pattern. But what we have now is, you know, as Amna said, after the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal last year, tensions have been rising. In the last few months, things have gone to an even higher level. So you've had attacks on commercial ships. You've had attacks on oil tankers, which the U.S. has blamed on Iran. And Iran has said they had nothing to do with them. You had Iran shooting down an American surveillance drone, which Iran has admitted to. They said it was over Iranian airspace. The Americans say, no, it was over. It was in international airspace. And then you have these recent events with Britain and the tanker. Then on the other hand, you have the Trump administration gradually ratcheting up or dramatically ratcheting up sanctions on everyone from the ICRG, which is the elite military in Iran, to the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, the Ayatollah. And threatening to put sanctions on the foreign minister, Javid Zarif. So there's a whole combination of things happening together. The U.S. and its supposed European allies are split over how you tackle Iran. And Iran is gradually doing things that would be in breach of the Iran nuclear deal. It's breached the 300 kilogram limit on the stockpile of enriched uranium it's allowed to keep under the deal. It started enriching uranium to a higher level than is allowed under the deal as a way to pressure the Europeans to provide a kind of relief to the Iranians that they need because of the American sanctions. So you have the Iranians at odds with the Europeans, the Iranians at odds with the Americans at odds with the Europeans. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any kind of coherent strategy in the U.S. in terms of how you get to a solution.
With regards to the nuclear deal, Laura, there was a United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency meeting in Austria this week, an emergency meeting to discuss the deal and what Dimitri was just describing, these recent moves by Iran to break its end of the bargain. Were there any big takeaways or outcomes or action items from this UN meeting, or was it just a chance for everyone to wring their hands in the same room?
Right. So the biggest thing that I took away from that is that this is a sign that the effort to kind of drive a wedge between the U.S. and Europe is actually may be working. One important thing to remember is that Iran really has no incentive to stop causing these problems in the Gulf or stop enriching uranium. Their economy that totally depends on oil is shot, and their only recourse really is to get sanctions relief from Europe. So they're gambling that doing these provocative actions in the Gulf will drive up oil prices, making Europeans feel the pinch and perhaps try to compromise. So during this meeting of the IAEA, the U.S. got pushback from Russia, China, and Europe, and they blamed the Trump administration for pulling out of the JCPOA for these problems that Iran is doing in the Gulf. So this doesn't seem to have a really easy solution, and these efforts may be working. It's not clear whether the U.S. is going to take any actions against Iran right now, but one thing that the U.S. military and the State Department may be trying to get progress on is to create a coalition, a maritime coalition, to protect tankers and commercial vessels in the Gulf.
And can we be clear, Laura, this increase in enriched uranium, what is that mean? Does that mean that Iran is closer to building a nuclear weapon?
So it means that Iran is slightly closer to producing a nuclear weapon. They're still many months away, but the first violation was enriching above the 300 kilogram level, like Dmitry said. The second violation was enriching to higher levels of uranium, so above 3.67% to 4.5%, I believe. Highly enriched uranium, which you need to build a nuclear bomb, is enriched beyond 90%. So it's going to take many months for them to enrich uranium to that level, and they need, I think, 25 kilograms of highly enriched uranium for the core of one nuclear bomb. Then they still have to get that into from gas to metal. They have to fit it with an explosive before actually making the bomb.
Amna?
And one of the things important to point out as they work towards that ultimate goal, as many believe, is that they've already set the clock ticking. They've basically said every 60 days, we're going to take another step that breaches that JCPOA, that nuclear deal, because until somebody does something to ease some of the sanctions pressure here. So they've already said, we're going to be working towards that. And two of the things that are important to point out. One is that they are still in compliance with the IAEA investigators. They're still working with them. They're still granting them access. And that is key for a number of reasons, because people say, experts who've been watching this and who can really take a look at the threat, say if they break with that relationship, if they stop cooperating with the IAEA, that is when the real concern begins.
Dmitry?
I think that the one other thing that's important to point out is that what Iran is trying to do is to put pressure on the Europeans to provide some kind of financial relief. The difficulty for the Europeans is the Americans are essentially saying, if you provide any relief to the Iranians via any channel, we are going to sanction you. So European companies have essentially pulled out of Iran. So it's very difficult to see what the Europeans can do in any kind of a substantial way that will make the Iranians happy without suffering the wrath of the Trump administration.
Now, Laura, I'd love you to respond to a comment from David, who wrote on our Facebook page, I really hope the war hawks in Washington realize Iran is much better prepared for war than Iraq was.
Well, I think it's actually important just to note that there is a question of whether Iran would actually pursue a nuclear weapon. It's not really clear that it's not really clear that it would be allowed under their religion. I believe the foreign minister has said that Iran will not become a nuclear state. And it's also not clear that it would really have strategic value. Israel already has nukes. The Saudi Arabia would likely get a nuclear weapon if Iran does. And now that could change with additional provocation from the U.S., such as if the U.S. were to launch a strike against Iran, then Iran could decide that getting a nuclear weapon is the best way to deter a U.S. attack. To the question, Iran does have a very strong military aside from nuclear weapons, so that they're more likely to lean on that.
Well, and maybe the play, theoretically, and again, I'm just spitballing here, but maybe the play is not to use a nuke, but maybe to sell one. I mean, Iran borders Pakistan, which is a nuclear state.
That's true. And that is definitely the concern that's been expressed by military and defense officials. The proliferation of a nuclear weapon is very dangerous.
Right. Speculation again, of course.
But, the other thing is, I mean, Pakistan already has nuclear weapons, so they don't actually need Iran to sell any to them.
Let me read one quick statement from Iran's ambassador to the UN agency that told a German newspaper on Wednesday, quote, "What we're doing only has one aim. We want to preserve the nuclear treaty. Everything can be reversed within a single hour if all of our partners in the treaty would just fulfill their obligations in the same way," unquote. I'm pretty sure they're talking about the United States with regards to that.
Oh, they're most definitely talking about the United States. I mean, it's easy to read between the lines on that. And look, I think this underscores just how massive the repercussions have been of the Trump administration's decision to just unilaterally pull out of the deal. And we knew it was coming. He ran on this. He campaigned on it. He called it the worst deal ever in history. And still, to this day, more than a year later, we're seeing that the ramifications of that decision extend far beyond just what the U.S. is able to participate in. The only thing that's happened since then has been a ratcheting up of tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Step by step, Iran pulling out of the deal, creating more of a threat, putting more pressure on our EU partners and allies who are still signatories to the deal to try to do something to mitigate the effects of the sanctions. And now you see the U.S. still calling for an increase in sanctions. Even at the IAEA meetings this week, you had the U.S. ambassador there participating in those talks and saying, we need to get you on board. We need to be ratcheting up and increasing these sanctions. There's no exit ramp to the discussion right now.
Laura?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out it was really interesting to watch the first Democratic presidential debates a couple weeks ago, because when asked about the Iran deal, none of the candidates said that they would return to the deal as it was. They all said that they would only return to a strengthened deal. So it seems like the table is set for the U.S. if it wants to try to restart negotiations, to try to get some inclusion of Iran's, as they call it, malign activity, ballistic missile launches, proliferating weapons of mass destruction to terrorists.
Which was a criticism of the original deal, that it covered certain nuclear activities but not certain weapons that might be involved.
Right, exactly. Kind of like I was saying on the previous segment, Iran having nukes is not the biggest problem in the Middle East. It's the ballistic missiles. It's the sponsoring terrorists around the world, even to Africa and South America.
And one quick question, Dimitri, before we move on, just to clarify, Jonathan tweeted, since the U.S. pulled out of the Iran deal, is there actually an Iran deal? Your guests keep talking as if the deal still exists. I'm confused.
Well, the deal technically still exists, but the Americans have withdrawn from it. The Europeans remain committed to it. Iran remains committed to it, but has started to breach the terms of the deal. At some point, if they go, a certain length and breach it in many, many more ways, I think the conclusion will be that the deal really doesn't exist at all in practice.
Let's shift gears and talk about Europe, where it has been a bad week for relations between the UK and the US. On Wednesday, the ambassador to the U.S. quit. His resignation was prompted by earlier leaked diplomatic cables from the British ambassador that described President Trump as inept. The president hit back on Twitter, calling the ambassador a very stupid guy and a pompous fool. Then it got worse in London. Boris Johnson, who is favored to become the new prime minister by some, failed to rally behind Sir Kim Darroch, the ambassador, when he was asked on TV if he would keep him in that post. The outrage to that was pretty swift. Here is a Minister of Parliament, Sir Alan Duncan, responding to that.
What is clear is that Boris Johnson did not defend him. And I think that is spineless. I think it's a failure of leadership. And I think his protests today are insincere guff.
That's Sir Alan Duncan, a Minister of Parliament, using such strong language. Guff. Sir, please, this is public radio. This has a lot of things going on. I mean, there's the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. There are these cables, which were probably never meant for public consumption. But then on top of that, there's this election. And there was a TV debate this week on ITV, one of the commercial broadcasters in the UK. So this is not purely diplomatic. Boris Johnson's trying to make some political hay with this, too.
None of this is happening in a vacuum. And this is most definitely not just about diplomatic cables, which you're absolutely right, are never meant to be consumed, certainly not by the general public, definitely not about the people they're writing about in the cables. To be clear, Kim Darroch was just doing his job, the same job that any other diplomat in Washington or any city around the world would do. I've covered enough countries that have what you describe as rough or tense relations with the U.S., where our own ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors on the ground, have to speak very frankly and very honestly when they're sending these cables back, because that's how the information gets where it needs to go to form leverage and influence and relationships and policy. That's just part of the job. The difference is here, the quiet part got said out loud. And we don't know where those cables came from. We don't know how they got leaked. But we do know that politically, they are advantageous for Boris Johnson, who is right now locked in a head-to-head battle for the prime minister position. And they do benefit him. I mean, this is someone who has said that if there is no deal for Brexit, for Britain to exit the European Union by the time the deadline comes around, they will leave with no deal. Derek is not an ally of Johnson's. It works to Boris Johnson's advantage to be able to say this or to have this out there and not have to defend him. And to be clear, in that debate, his opponent, Jeremy Hunt, did come step up to defend the ambassador here. So this isn't just about diplomacy. This isn't just about the ambassador. He was sort of collateral damage in a larger political debate.
With regards to the diplomatic part, Laura, just a purely diplomatic part, it seems like there was, well, I wonder how you see it, that there may have been nowhere else for this to go. When the president says he's not going to deal with you anymore, that's kind of it.
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, it did seem like an inevitable conclusion. But I think it's important to point out that his resignation and everything that's happened here will have a chilling effect on the remaining diplomats. A lot of people, like you touched on, may think twice before offering their honest assessments, which is what is so important in the diplomatic world. But this is not actually the first time that something like this has happened. In 2010, WikiLeaks published a massive stash of documents about how U.S. ambassadors really felt about their hosts. So you had a senior state Department official posted in Italy calling then Prime Minister Berlusconi feckless, vain, and ineffective. So this was obviously caused a lot of backlash, but also a lot of self-censorship, leaving D.C., leaving Washington sort of out of the loop a little bit in what was going on in the diplomatic circles.
Dimitri?
I mean, I just point out that, for example, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell, has said much worse things on the record, including to our newspaper and others, about Germany and Angela Merkel than Kim Darroch ever wrote in any of the cables that we've seen. I mean, the truth is the British on kind of Monday and Tuesday, Kim Darroch thought that he could probably ride this out because, frankly, Donald Trump tweets about a lot of people and many of them are still in their jobs, even if a few of them have gone. The final straw was Boris Johnson. I mean, Kim Darroch watched the debate between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt. And after that debate, he realized Boris Johnson has thrown me under the bus and he decided to resign. And I take a slightly different view on how it's playing in the UK. Actually, there's been a huge backlash against Boris Johnson and a lot of criticism that he's not willing to defend the Foreign Service, which he led as Foreign Secretary. And a question is whether he's willing to kind of suck up to Donald Trump and throw his own country under the bus if and when he becomes Prime Minister. But Boris Johnson was the final nail in the coffin. And Boris Johnson actually called Kim Darroch the next day and apologized. But by then, it was too late.
We should also note that President Trump also attacked the outgoing Prime Minister, Theresa May. He tweeted that she ignored his advice and on Brexit went, quote, her own foolish way, a disaster, unquote. Mrs. May apparently thought that crossed the line. Here's part of what she told the House of Commons.
Good government depends on public servants being able to give full and frank advice. And I hope the House will reflect on the importance of defending our values and principles, particularly when they are under pressure.
It's Theresa May, the outgoing Prime Minister, speaking to the House of Commons. Dimitri, this is kind of the thing that ambassadors are supposed to be able to do. I mean, they put a good face for their nation to their host nation in terms of official diplomatic dealings, but behind closed doors, they kind of got to speak to their bosses in the way that allows them to make decisions.
Well, they've got two jobs to do. One job is to make friends in the U.S. administration here so that you know what's going on and you can advance your country's interests. And your other job is to tell your prime minister or your president what's actually happening here. I mean, with Theresa May, I mean, the criticisms from Donald Trump are interesting because he made exactly the same criticism standing beside her at her country residence in Chequers in the U.K. when he visited in 2017. He said, you know, I gave Theresa some advice and she didn't take it. I think she should have taken it. So this is not the first time she's heard that. It's very easy for Donald Trump to criticize Theresa May now because within 2 weeks, she's not going to be the prime minister.
One other UK story before we move on that received a little less attention but is very significant was a vote that was taken to make same-sex marriage and abortion legal in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, and with this amendment that passed, it means that now the entire United Kingdom has legalized same-sex marriage and abortion. The Catholic-Protestant divide is very real in Northern Ireland, but it took Parliament in London to change these laws, right?
Right. And basically those laws, well, I think it's important to point out it hasn't changed the law necessarily, that this vote comes basically in a power vacuum in Northern Ireland because the governing coalition collapsed back in 2017. So this is a vote that could change the law, but then that could be changed back once that new coalition comes into power in Northern Ireland. But yeah, actually, culturally, it is huge. It not only highlights the divide between the two regions, but also shows you just how quickly things can change on the ground. I think polling has shown that by and large, people do support those laws being changed. So we'll see if the laws actually catch up to that.
Dimitri?
I mean, just historically, as someone who grew up in Dublin, what's interesting is the Catholic majority in Northern Ireland are more supportive now of same-sex marriage and abortion than the unionists who want to remain in the UK. So there's been a total cultural change in Northern Ireland in the last 20 years. But until the power vacuum problem is fixed, very little is going to happen there.
Let's talk about Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel has been in the news after she was seen shaking somewhat violently during three different public appearances over the last month. Yesterday, she broke protocol and sat down instead of standing up while national anthems played during a state visit. After that event, she told reporters not to worry about her. Angela Merkel is 64. She's led Germany since 2005 and announced she will step down 2 years from now. Laura, what do we take from this story? I mean, the fact that she's shaking, it feels almost like the Hillary Clinton story where there was that shot and people say, oh, is Hillary Clinton well enough to lead the country or is she falling apart? Like, what is this story really about?
That's true. And let's not forget Michelle Bachmann back in 2012 when she, or 2011 when she had migraines and all of a sudden people were questioning her ability to serve as president.
Because I don't remember hearing anybody say that about Bob Dole.
Right.
When he was running. I don't hear that about male candidates or male heads of state when they shake or when they're frail. I've only heard this lately about women.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. But on the other hand, when you're dehydrated and you're visibly shaking, I do think that it is fair to question someone. I think if that were President Donald Trump up there and he's shaking, I think it would be fair to question the health or at least express some concern about the health of that leader. But it is unfortunate that likely this is happening in the background of some sexist remarks.
What would it mean? Just setting that aside for a second, what would it mean if Angela Merkel had to leave office sooner than planned? She's played an increasingly important role in Europe lately, especially as Europe has been changing politically so much so fast.
Angela Merkel's role, not just in Europe, but in the world, has changed significantly with the election of Donald Trump here in the U.S. And a lot of that sort of leader of the free world type center of gravity has shifted towards her. One of the reasons I think this resonated and this caught so many people's attention is because of her reputation. She has been known for her stamina. She is the one who is up before anyone else and leading late night meetings and negotiations and always seems to have the energy of three people behind her. And while, yes, there is a lot more scrutiny of female leaders and elected officials than there tends to be of male, it's a legitimate question. Part of the reason it's a question is because her office has basically swatted back any details or answers and said it's not a problem. She herself has said as quickly as it came on, it will leave. Well, what is it? There's really no details, so that leaves a lot of people to fill in the details and speculate wildly. But it would be, it would be devastating if she were. We're getting way ahead of ourselves here. Of course, we have no idea what is actually wrong here. They've said dehydration. We'll wait and see if there's any information to fill in.
Dimitri?
I mean, I agree with what everyone has said about the sexism, and I think that totally exists. But I do think in this case, Angela Merkel is one of the most important leaders in the world. And if you look at the videos of her shaking, this is not a little minor thing. She is shaking uncontrollably.
It's pretty noticeable.
On three occasions, she has to clasp her hands to try and stop it. And now they're forcing her to sit down so that, she's under less pressure. There's a clear question about her health. We don't know what it is. I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to speculate. But because she hasn't revealed any information about what's going on, it just makes it more, it makes it worse, and people are starting to suspect there's something going on there.
Let me stick with you, Dimitri, for a second, because speaking of the changing Europe, we should talk about Greece. There was some good news for another center-right party this week, because Greece elected a new prime minister. Kyriakos Mitsotakis and his New Democracy Party won a majority of seats in Greece's parliament, defeating the leftist prime minister, Alexis Tsipras. Now, Greece has been going through a lot in the last decade. Remind us, Dimitri, of what's been going on.
Well, I mean, Greece suffered massively because of the financial crisis globally and also because many of its own self-inflicted problems. Alexis Tsipras came in as prime minister on a platform of pushing back against some of the pressure from the European Union and the IMF to implement pro-austerity programs, which have sent Greek unemployment up to massive levels. It's actually improved, but Greek unemployment is 18% today. You can imagine how high that is. But Tsipras over time had to accept some of the IMF and the European Union pressure because Greece was going to plunge out of the euro. So he was forced to do a slight U-turn. As a result, it's given an opportunity for the center-right New Democracy Party to come back. Mitsotakis is actually the son of a former prime minister, and Greece has a history of that kind of family members following the same footsteps of their parents. Another interesting thing about the Greek election, though, is that Golden Dawn, which is this far-right anti-immigrant party, which had done better in the last elections, didn't reach the threshold to have seats in parliament. So it's another example of what seems to be a slight kind of the pendulum in Europe coming back a little bit more towards the center, partly because the flow of refugees from Syria and the Middle East over the last 2 years has started to subside. And that was one of the huge drivers of the populist anti-immigration movements in Europe.
Let's shift gears and talk about Hong Kong. After weeks of major protests there, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, suspended this controversial extradition bill that was behind the protests. Many of the protesters are skeptical that it is, as Lam claimed, dead. Amna Nawaz, why is there so much skepticism about the fate of this bill?
So this is an extradition bill that would basically allow Beijing to extradite suspected criminals from Hong Kong to the mainland. Obviously, for pro-democracy activists, that is a huge concern. And we saw those protests that have been unfolding for weeks now turn violent to some degree when a small group of them were able to break into the legislature and vandalize the area to some degree. It really ratcheted up pressure on Carrie Lam. Now, Carrie Lam has handled this by basically saying, no, the bill is dead. There was some very specific language that was used that wasn't satisfying to the protesters because for them, the bill only goes away if it is fully withdrawn. If it has no chance of ever being revived, of ever actually going to effect, that has not happened yet. So they are not yet satisfied. They are now locked in this battle with Carrie Lam, who's basically seen by them as a stooge of Beijing. And the demands are basically increasing too. This bill is not enough. They obviously want to be able to elect their own democratic candidates as well. They're worried, obviously, more largely about the influence that Beijing has on their government.
Laura, can we clarify a little bit what we mean by extradition? You know, it's one thing to want to have an extradition agreement with another country for murderers or terrorists or so on. The concern here, as I understand it, is that those kinds of criminals could certainly be extradited from Hong Kong back to mainland China, but it could also be just people who publish something on the web that Xi Jinping doesn't like.
Right, exactly. I think the real concern here is that Beijing is growing harsher and harsher in terms of in terms of imposing these really harsh things on Hong Kong, which has always been governed, seen itself as to some extent a separate country. So I think that the concern here is that I think the concern Beijing has is that since this bill has been withdrawn or suspended, and because of this protest, I think the concern is Beijing looking weak in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of these protesters, and the real concern is that they think that this will send a signal that the government of Beijing will actually back down in the face of popular pressure. There have already been a lot of calls for more freedoms and democratic reforms. So I think the repercussions on this and what happens next, especially with Carrie Lam, whether she resigns or whether the government doubles down on this bill, I think could be pretty extreme. And the U.S. has now gotten involved in this, too. The national security team, Bolton, Pompeo, and Vice President Pence met with some Hong Kong activists recently, and this caused a lot of frustration in Beijing, particularly ahead of this upcoming U.S.-China meeting to try to defuse some of the trade talks. So this is definitely going to increase frustrations between the U.S. and China.
Now, contrast that, Dimitri, with some of your reporting from this week about some assurances that President Trump apparently gave to China's President Xi Jinping related to Hong Kong. What have you learned?
So I was at the G20 in Osaka where Trump and Xi met, and two things happened. In that meeting and in a phone call ahead of that meeting where the two leaders spoke, Donald Trump said to Xi Jinping that he or his administration would tone down criticisms of the erosion of freedoms in Hong Kong, which are basically sparked by China. Now, that doesn't prevent Pompeo and Mike Pence from meeting Jimmy Lai, the pro-democracy activist, and some other people, Martin Lee, a famous politician in Hong Kong. But Trump himself has actually said very, very little about what's been happening in Hong Kong. And just to put it in context, we talk about big marches in Hong Kong. One-third of the population, which is 2 million people, came out on the streets. Can you imagine if one-third of the population of America came out on the streets for something?
That would be that more than 100 million people.
A huge story. And the kind of the backdrop here is that when Britain returned Hong Kong to mainland China, to the PRC in 1997, they came up with a 50-year arrangement of one country, two systems, where Hong Kong maintains a separate legal system and everything except for foreign affairs is managed by Hong Kong. Foreign affairs is managed by Beijing. But in 2047, Hong Kong will revert to being a purely Chinese city. And there's a glide path from now until then where China is increasingly eroding the freedoms in Hong Kong. The people of Hong Kong don't have the ability to elect their leader. There's no universal suffrage, which is what sparked the huge protests, the Umbrella Revolution in 2014. And there's no real way to reverse this. The UK does criticize some of these things when they happen, but not very strongly. The US does criticize these abuses, but not very strongly. It's very difficult to reverse it. And I think the people of Hong Kong know that they really are on a slippery slope, and no one knows how you're going to change that situation.
Well, with regards to that slope, Amna, when you look at the protests from this extradition bill, the height of them, some of the most like violent, like the rioting and property destruction, you know, they broke into the legislature and kind of hung the old flag that flew during the British days when Hong Kong was part of the United Kingdom. This kind of feels like it's on this inexorable path to a conflict over 2047, where the people of Hong Kong know what the future looks like, but then there is this younger population that says, we don't care what deal you made, it's wrong, and we're not going to live in a Hong Kong like that.
It's really hard to see how this plays out. It's difficult to see how either side backs down at any point right now. Carrie Lam is in an untenable position, right? Because to Laura's point earlier, Beijing does not want to be seen to be negotiating with these activists, with a full third of the population there to back off and say, okay, if you do this again, we will relent on what we want to see happen. At the same time, a full third of the population is calling for greater control and agency over what happens to them in their own territory. And it's not just about this extradition bill. As I mentioned before, they've seen in the past when they've had some candidates and elected officials who were known to be pro-democracy removed by Beijing or prevented from running for office. There's been real direct influence there. So yes, tensions have been rising. The numbers have been growing. It's very difficult to see where and how any of this de-escalates anytime soon.
Laura?
Again, looking at the broader picture, this is not just about Hong Kong, right? This is about China and the greater dispute with the U.S. and with the rest of the world, which goes into trade. It goes into militarization of the South China Sea. So China really does not want to be seen as backing down from its core values. And this is sort of could be seen as sort of the culmination of this, an example of this. And what happens next will really, I think, have an impact on the talks with the U.S. and China's leverage.
Well, and increasingly, Dimitri, the world needs China. Like, China's too big a player. It's asserting too much of its influence across the South China Sea, parts of Africa. Like, it's not like some small country that we can say now. No, China's a player that the world can't really push around.
No, China is essentially on its way to becoming the second superpower. And with respect to Hong Kong, notwithstanding what's happening there and how we've arrived at this place, it's also important to point out that Hong Kong was originally part of China. the British came in and colonized it. So you can understand why the Chinese feel very strongly about Hong Kong. But I just wanted to make one point about the protests. While it's true that there are some very prominent violent incidents, the vast majority of those have been incredibly peaceful, to the point that back in 2014, I was living in Hong Kong. I took my 2-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter down to what was called Democracy Square because it was so peaceful. It was like going to a kind of Berkeley campus on a sunny day when everyone was out reading their books in the sun. So 2 million people protesting, actually the amount of violence compared to what it could be was really minimal. But it gets played up, obviously.
I used to teach at Berkeley. You just kind of took me back to 2016. And that is exactly what it's like on a Sunday afternoon, usually. A few more big stories we want to talk about before our time is up, including with regards to Turkey. It's a NATO member, and it just got its first shipment of a Russian missile defense system, which is something the U.S. has very strongly opposed. A number of you have commented on this. Brian emailed, "So Trump, the master negotiator, has lost a deal with a major ally in the Middle East to the Russians? Wow, I guess Trump really does trust Putin more than our long-term steadfast friends." That's kind of the crux of this issue, Lara, is that NATO is supposed to be this kind of bloc that has enough juice to oppose Russia, and now Turkey, which is kind of a black sheep member of NATO, is doing business with Russia.
Right. So there's a lot to unpack here. And one thing a lot of people don't know is that this has actually been a really long time coming. The U.S. has been offering Turkey a different missile defense system, the Patriot, since 2012, 2013. And Turkey actually turned it down twice before this deal they made with Russia. And I think that the biggest implication that this could have is it really could potentially break Turkey from NATO. Or, first of all, it signals that Turkey is moving toward Russia, away from the United States, away from its NATO allies, because the U.S. has been signaling for a year now that it would have significant repercussions if Turkey does go through with this buy of the Russian missile system. So what's going to happen now is that the Trump administration is debating what kind of package of sanctions it's going to impose on Turkey because of this. Because due to the law, there is legislation saying that it would automatically trigger sanctions. The only question really is quite how devastating the sanctions will be. The most severe could be completely cutting the Turkish government or the Turkish Air Force off from the U.S. financial system, which would not only obviously hurt their business, but also scare off potential foreign investors as well. The bulk of the national security team is behind imposing the most severe sanctions on Turkey for this breach. But the one wild card could actually be the president himself, since, as you know, his personal relationship with Erdogan has previously led to some unexpected shifts in policy. So he could potentially choose to waive or delay these sanctions.
So there's the relationship between President Trump and President Erdogan of Turkey. There's also, Amna, this point that Ray in Virginia Beach, Virginia made. Love to know what you think of what he said. Ray emailed, "Why should NATO be angry with Turkey when our so-called NATO allies are planning a gas pipeline to purchase gas from the Russians? If there is a conflict, the Russians could cut off the gas as they did in Ukraine. Why give the Russians hard currency?" Is there a little bit of hypocrisy going on here?
Sure. There's always plenty of hypocrisy to go around, right? And that is a line we've heard from President Trump as well, which is, why am I being criticized for how I talk about Russia or how hard I am on Russia or not when you have this other deal that's going on? And that's absolutely true. To Laura's point earlier about what she'd pointed out was these relationships are shifting, and specifically between the U.S. and Turkey, it's a completely different relationship now, specifically between Trump and Erdogan, than it's ever been before. NATO is almost sort of just a backdrop against which is happening that doesn't quite matter as much anymore. But I interviewed Erdogan last year, and I'd asked him, this was at a time of sort of heightened tension because of whether or not the U.S. was going to keep troops in Syria. Of course, there was an interest in protecting our Kurdish allies in northern Syria, and there was a lot of tension between the two countries at that point.
Who the Turks do not like.
Exactly. And I'd asked Erdogan, you know, do you even consider yourself an ally of the U.S. anymore? How do you see this relationship? And I'm paraphrasing what he's saying here, but it's basically been reduced to a transactional relationship. There is not a shared mission. There is not a deeper alliance upon which the two countries are working together. In areas where their interests overlap, Erdogan is happy to work with the U.S. In areas where he overlaps with Russia, he's happy to do that too. And that's where we are today.
One more arms sales story, Lara, that we should mention, which has to do with Taiwan. It's also getting some new military equipment. after the U.S. approved a $2.2 billion sale. Now, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen made a stop in the U.S. yesterday on her way to visit Caribbean allies. She spoke at a reception in New York. Here's part of what she said.
Taiwan will defend its democratic system. Our democracy hasn't come easily, and it's now being threatened by forces overseas.
That's Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen speaking yesterday in New York. Laura, can you just give us a brief sense of what the U.S. has agreed to sell Taiwan? And I'm sure China has reacted to that.
Yeah, so the U.S. in this most recent package has agreed to sell Taiwan $2.2 billion of Abrams tanks and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, which, well, it's certainly not the first time the U.S. has sold Taiwan arms. It is actually one of the primary arms sellers to Taiwan, but it is the big. It would be the biggest package. The thing is that there is another arms package pending that is potentially three or four or five even times as large. It could be as much as $10 billion worth of F-16s, new F-16 fighter jets that the U.S. is trying to sell to Taiwan. And that is something that China has said would cross a red line. And that's something that would be extremely, extremely provocative and would surely prompt a backlash.
Dimitri, before we go?
It's important to point out that under U.S. law, the administration is required to provide Taiwan with defensive weapons. So you're essentially on a kind of a glide path here where increasingly if the U.S. continues to provide weapons and China gets increasingly angry, at some point you could have a very dangerous situation. But this has been going on for some time.
So this is kind of an inexorable conflict in a way?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I had a kicker to read about Ringo Starr. And I know Ringo doesn't get much respect, but we're actually out of time. So I can't read it. I know. It's almost like I'm making it worse, aren't I? I'm making
so
it worse.
So disappointed.
Don't even. I'm going to tweet out the kicker, doggone it, because Ringo needs love too. You got a problem with that, Amna?
I will retweet.
Well, thank you. I will hold you to that. Amna Nawaz, national correspondent and sub-anchor for the PBS NewsHour. Amna, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Thanks, Dimitri.
Thank you.
And Laura Seligman, Pentagon correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
1A's senior editorial team is Denise Couture, Danielle Knight, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Miranda Fulmore edits the show. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.